Conrad was stationed at Miramar, California, requalifying for a phase of the Navy fighter jock's training he had already been through, which was night carrier landings. There was a good reason why night carrier landings required requalifying time, even as in Conrad's case, after training as a test pilot at Patuxent. Night landings were a routine part of carrier operations, and perhaps the best of all examples of how a man's accumulated good works did him no good whatsoever at each new step up the Great Pyramid, of how each new step was an absolute test, of how each bright new day's absolutes, chosen or damned, were built into the routine. By 1962, the Navy had already shifted over to light beam systems using angled mirrors and Fresnel lenses at the end of the flight deck. Conrad and the rest of them going through night carrier training at Miramar did not have to depend on a landing signal officer standing at the end of the deck in a luminescent orange suit waving a pair of luminescent orange wig-wag flags. At night, to the pilot, way up there in the dark, there was now a blob of light, known as the meatball, rising and falling on a dimly perceived little slab in the middle of the ocean. The shining blob, the motherless meatball, was rising and falling because the heaving, greasy skillet did not stop wallowing in the waves simply out of respect for the night. The carrier was plowing on away from you, into the wind, and therefore into the waves, and therefore was pitching up and down, 5, 8, even 10 feet at a gulp. On a night when the clouds were low and the moon was obscured, when the sky was black, the ocean was black, and the deck was black, the little meatball, no more than an inch high from up there, and the lights on the ship were like a single low-wattage comet, dim and lurching through the vast blackness of the universe, and the pilot was expected to have the will, the moxie, the illustrious, the all-illuminating stuff to bring a 5 or 10 ton jet fighter onto that dim, drunken astral plate at 125 knots. In training, he had a limited number of passes down the invisible glide path. If he couldn't bring himself to make contact with the deck for so long that his fuel ran low, then the word bingo sounded over his earphones, and he had to return to land, to the training base, where the landing strip didn't move when you approached it, and where everybody on the flight line would know that another poor and sad bingo was coming into a safe haven, having funked it in the business of night carrier landings. A persistent case of the bingos was enough to wash a man out of night carrier landings. That did not mean you were finished as a Navy pilot. It merely meant that you were finished so far as carrier ops were concerned, which meant that you were finished so far as combat was concerned, which meant that you were no longer in the competition, no longer ascending the pyramid, no longer qualified for the company of those with the right stuff. To have every recommendation in the book as a test pilot, to have survived bad strings galore, meant nothing when such a thing happened. Chosen or damned, it could blow at any scene. There were nights when the little meatball way down yonder on the deck was jumping around like the silver BBs in those maddening games you hold in the palm of your hand, and a pilot would have to drive his F-4, a big 15-ton brute, down onto the deck through sheer willpower, drive it down practically like a nail. Anything, even the great kaboom, was better than hearing bingo over your earphones. To bingo out of a carrier landing after 8 years of military flying, after completing test pilot school at Pax River, after becoming the top of the breed, now, there you had something unthinkable. Conrad had just requalified for night carrier landings for all weather carrier operations, meaning that he was now fully qualified for Navy air combat, when he received his invitation to apply for astronaut. The fact that there was nothing in the role of astronaut that could require one-tenth the piloting skill of night carrier landings did not deter Conrad, Lovell, or anyone else for a second this time around. This time, Conrad went through the selection process like Lieutenant Straight Arrow. As before, there were 30-odd finalists. They did not have to go through the Lovelace Clinic or the Wright-Patterson Aero Medical Center, however. Instead, they were sent to Brooks Air Force Base in San Antonio, the Air Force's medical center, for a set of physicals that were time-consuming but on the whole conventional. After 5 Mercury flights, it was obvious that no extraordinary physical hardiness was required for the job. For the last phase of the testing, they took you straight to Olympus, which was now Houston. Part of the testing was a formal interview across a table with NASA engineers, plus Deke Slayton, John Glenn, and Al Shepard concerning technical matters. But part of it seemed to be social. You were expected to go to a cocktail party and a dinner in a private dining room in the Rice Hotel in Houston, with the Mercury astronauts in attendance. Al Shepard was there for a while, and Gus Grissom, Scott Carpenter, and here was Wally. You kept your brain dialed up in all sectors, trying to strike the perfect middle ground between being a good righteous beer call buddy and showing good sober respect for the eminence of those already in the club. Maybe I'd better hold it down to just one drink. It was like a rush party in a fraternity you desperately wanted to belong to. Naturally, Wally talked to Conrad and Jim Lovell as if he were the same old Wally, comrade-in-arms, good old Wally of Group 20. Nevertheless, the difference in their ranks existed in that room like a ray of light which beamed straight upon Walter Schirra, outstandingly successful single combat warrior. For there were now the 7 Mercury astronauts up there at the apex and all the rest of the pilots in America far below. Not that the original 7's natural eminence altered the true and secret nature of things, however. The self-esteem of the fighter jock knew no limits, and the members of Group 2 were no exceptions to this rule. As soon as they were selected, the boys began looking around and comparing themselves, the next 9, with the original 7. Here was Neil Armstrong, who had flown the X-15, what Mercury astronaut had done anything like that. Here was John Young, who held 2 world speed to climb records, what Mercury astronaut other than Glenn could claim any such distinction. Here were Frank Borman, Tom Stafford, and Jim McDivitt, who had been flight test instructors at Edwards. What Mercury astronaut had ever qualified for that, except for Slayton? The next 9 were really rolling now. The original 7 were chosen to withstand stress. Period. Look at Carpenter. Look at Cooper. Oh, the next 9 felt very good about themselves. Nevertheless, the exalted status of the original 7 was a fact. Once initial euphoria of being chosen as an astronaut had subsided, Conrad and the others realized that now, for all their righteous stuff, they occupied a somewhat humiliating position in the Corps of Astronauts. They were like plebes, rookies, fraternity pledges. Gus Grissom had a nice, grim, ingratiating, gruff Gus way of telling them, if their paths had to cross here and there, not to get big ideas, not to go around calling themselves astronauts. You're not an astronaut, he would say. You're a trainee. You're not an astronaut until you go up. He said it without a trace of a smile. The next 9 spent their time going to classes like 9 freshmen, like 9 primary flight training candidates at Pensacola, which was bad enough, and doing scut work for the Holy 7, which was worse. That was how Conrad ended up being John Glenn's gopher and carrying his bags. It could get cold as hell here on Olympus. There were levels upon levels, even here at the top. At the very apex, there was John Glenn, and there were others among the original 7 themselves who could not get over that fact. At the very first press conference, the one introducing the next 9 to the public, the original 7 were on hand, and Shorty Powers happened to introduce them in the reverse order of their flights. When he got to Shepard, he said, "And finally, this is Alan Shepard, the man who's been saying for years, 'But I was first!'" Well, that just cracked the place up. Everyone was laughing with the single and obvious exception of Smiling Al. He didn't even move a lip. If Slow Burns gave off needle rays, Shorty Powers would have had 2 small green holes through his frontal lobes. And you realize all at once that after Glenn's great orbital triumph, Shepard, the prime pilot, the first American in space, must have felt like a forgotten man. Nobody ranked with Glenn, however, not even Webb, the administrator of NASA. One day, Glenn dropped by Webb's office in Washington and informed him that there was going to be a change in his personal agenda. He was going to make no more trips for NASA at the request of this or that congressman or senator. He was no longer going to fly halfway across the country, nor would he walk across the street to stand on a platform to please some congressman who was looking for votes or whatever else. Glenn didn't put it as a request. He was letting Webb know how it was going to be from now on. He was just laying down the law. There was no way for Webb to take it except as a direct contradiction of his authority. Webb answered in a reasonable, if somewhat aroused, manner. "Now listen, John. We don't send you anywhere because some congressman wants you to be there. We send you because NASA wants you to be there. Congressional support is absolutely essential at this point, and this is one of the most important things you could possibly do for the program." To which Glenn says that, nevertheless, he is taking no more such trips. Webb's color begins to rise, and he says that if he is instructed to carry out such duties, then he will be obliged to carry them out. To which Glenn says that Webb happens to be mistaken. He will do no such thing. All at once, it's practically a shouting match. Webb didn't push the situation to the brink. He just let the storm wear itself out, and when it was over, it was obvious that the administrator of NASA was not a chief so long as John Glenn was in the room. Glenn did not back down or apologize. Far from it. He made it obvious who held the cards around here, and that was that. It was John Glenn who had realized from the first that Project Mercury was like a new branch of the armed services, despite its civilian coloration. It would have simplified matters tremendously if NASA had given everybody formal rankings and had done with it. That way, people such as Webb would have known where they actually stood. The seven Mercury astronauts could have been designated single combat general, a category with the honors and privileges of five-star general, but with none of the duties and obligations of command. After his flight, John Glenn then would have been promoted to galactic single combat general, a category ranking slightly above chief of staff of the armed services and slightly below commander-in-chief. Webb, as NASA administrator, would have been a two-star general and would have known the protocol for dealing with GSC General Glenn. Newly inducted astronauts such as Conrad, Lovell, and Young could have been ranked as majors with rapid promotion promised in the event of successful completion of flights. It would have greatly simplified matters for the wives as well, for as much as they would have denied it, had anyone confronted them with the topic, many of the wives of the original seven reacted to the arrival of the next nine and their wives, precisely like service wives, since time was. The classic and often told story of service wives concerns the wives of a group of Navy pilots who had just been transferred to a new base. A commander designated to give the wives an orientation lecture says, "First, would you ladies please arrange yourselves by rank, with the highest-ranking wives sitting in the first row, and so on back to the rear." It takes about 15 minutes for the women to sort themselves out and change their seats, since very few of them know one another. Once the process has been completed, the commander fixes a stern glare upon them and says, "Ladies, I want you to know that I have just witnessed the most ridiculous performance I have ever seen in my entire military career. Allow me to inform you that no matter who your husbands are, you have no rank whatsoever. You are all equals, and you should kindly remember to conduct yourselves as such in all dealings with one another." That was not the end of the story, however. The wives stared back at their instructor with looks of utter bemusement and, as if with a single mind, said to themselves, "Who is this idiot and what planet has he been stationed on?" For the inexpressible provisions of the military wife's combat were well known to all. A military officer's wife rose in rank with her husband and immediately took on all the honors and perquisites pertaining thereto, and only a fool or the sort of simple-minded jerk who was assigned to give orientation lectures to wives could fail to comprehend this. Further, said the code, the wise wife of a junior officer was careful not to make her family's style of living so ostentatious that it outdazzled that of higher-ranking families. It was on just this point that the next nine began to rankle some of the wives of the original seven, and, for that matter, some of the seven astronauts as well. They were irritated to notice what terrific houses many of the next nine immediately bought. Just like that, in Timber Cove even, they began gobbling up the goodies. For the original seven, the ascension from the drab life of the junior officer had seemed like a glorious pioneer struggle, and part of the prize for winning the contest, for being chosen as the original seven. They found something distasteful about the attitude of the new crowd, this notion that as soon as a man was designated an astronaut, he and his family were entitled to stride out upon the golden boulevards of the celestial city as if they owned the place. The Group 2 astronauts immediately produced an agent, their version of Leo d'Orsay, and sat down to negotiate and cut up the life pie. He was Harry Batten, president of the M.W. Ayer Advertising Agency in Philadelphia. He was as much of a big leaguer as d'Orsay, and like d'Orsay, he agreed to serve as agent without pay. It was a bit too much. People were already treating the next nine like the original seven. The developers in Timber Cove and Nassau Bay, the second-best development, offered them big houses for small down payments and huge mortgages at low interest. A mortgage of $40,000 to $50,000 seemed enormous in 1962, and the next nine took it all on without even blinking. They were not behaving like junior officers in the presence of the single combat generals, for as everyone understood, tacitly, this was no mere civilian agency. This was a new branch of the service. It was in that spirit that the AWSC was started. Without anyone coming out and saying so, it was understood that Marge Sladen was the CO's wife in this outfit. By now, Deke had taken on his job as coordinator of astronaut activities with such determination that he was about to be put in charge of crew selection, meaning that he would be the one man who had the most to say about who flew and in what order, particularly when it came to the next nine. He was about to be made assistant director of flight crew operations. He became the equivalent of a commanding officer, making Marge the CO's wife. Marge organized a couple of coffee hours for all the wives, the first seven and the next nine, so they could all get together and know each other. By the second time they met, they all realized without a word, nobody had to say it, what this was. This was the Officers' Wives Club, such as existed at every base in the land. One of the newcomers who seemed absolutely tickled to death about the coffee hours was Sue Borman, the wife of one of the next nine, Frank Borman. Frank Borman had been one of the first instructors at the Air Force's new experimental test pilot school at Edwards. He was a short, compact West Point man from Arizona, and his wife, Sue, was the perfect, super-efficient officer's wife. She had a fireproof cheeriness about her and a determination to get things organized. They were a great team. "This is fun," she said, speaking of Marge's coffee hours for the wives. "Let's start doing this on an organized basis." So the AWSC began. The initial stood for Astronaut Wives Club, of course, but the full name was never used. It was a gaffe for an astronaut or an astronaut's wife to use the word astronaut. Marge herself was always talking about the fellows. Besides, the full name would make the military analogy too pointed. The AWSC was no great delight to most of the wives of the original seven, however. Some of the newcomers, such as Sue Borman, was too gung-ho about it all. That was what they would tell themselves. In fact, the newcomers acted too equal about it all. There was no protocol for showing the deference due single combat generals' wives. The wives of the original seven began attending the monthly AWC hours less and less. Betty Grissom almost never showed up, but then Betty had hated tea time functions from the very beginning. If one was going to feel ill at ease in the cheery chit-chat game and not be treated as the Honorable Mrs. Single Combat General, why bother? For both the wives and the men, there was at first an oaken bucket nostalgia for the early days, the Langley era, the pioneer period, the period of youth and idealism and Spartan courage and Yahoo cowboy disregard for the bureaucratic proprieties. You would even see engineers and support personnel who had moved from Langley and the Cape here to Houston getting misty about those old days 3 years ago. The new facility, the manned spacecraft center, was taking shape out in the middle of 1,000 acres of absolutely flat gumbo pasture. The buildings were great squat beige cubes set at grandiose intervals from one another and connected by wide roads, veritable highways lined with aluminum light poles. The place looked like one of those industrial parks that were always being touted in the real estate sections of the Sunday newspapers. Nevertheless, it was obvious that something of vast proportions was underway, and given a rosy enough picture of what lies down the road, a man could get over a case of homesickness soon enough. Perhaps Houston, the boomtown of boomtowns, was just the place for the expansion occurring in the space program. After a while, you could begin to appreciate Houston's energy and its sense of the grand sweep, the risk-all plunge, and Timber Cove and Nassau Bay and the other new housing developments out by Clear Lake weren't half bad, it turned out. In fact, they were luxury itself compared to what you found around most air bases. And the locals out here in this erstwhile farming country were really good folks. 2/3 of NASA had already geared up for projects Gemini and Apollo, and the great race to beat the Soviets to the moon. Just imagine what waited here on Earth for the first man to walk on the moon. And the boys could imagine it. You had only to look at John Glenn. Glenn had not been the first man to fly in Earth orbit, or even the second, merely the first American. Yet he had ascended to a status so extraordinary, it had no precedent. Some of the boys were convinced that Glenn had his eyes set on becoming president. Nor was the notion far-fetched, after all. It was David who had succeeded the throne of Saul. Glenn now moved in a world full of the Kennedys, the Johnsons, senators, congressmen, foreign dignitaries, heads of corporations, VIPs of every description. Next to John Kennedy himself, John Glenn was probably the best known and most admired American in the world. Oh, the boys were aware of all that. Just ask Al Shepard. Although, of course, no one did. Al was now in training as backup for Gordon Cooper's flight, which would be in May 1963. Gordo, the last in line, had drawn what was shaping up as the final flight in the Mercury series. 34 hours, 22 orbits, designed to put the United States into the game with the Soviets, who had now achieved flights of 17, 64, and 48 orbits. The original planning had called for 4 long-duration flights, with the second one lasting 3 days. Shepard had been counting on that. He was desperate for an orbital flight. His suborbital flight, as well as Grissom's, now seemed terribly insignificant. As for Gus, he was already getting revved up for the Gemini program, spending lots of time in St. Louis where McDonnell was building the Gemini spacecraft. Gus had put the gloom of his flight behind him and was looking ahead to Gemini and Apollo. His friend Deke was in charge of crew selection for the 2 new programs and was throwing himself heart and soul into the job, and not just because he enjoyed the exercise of his newly found power. The main thing was that he would be on top of every flight from beginning to end, familiar with every detail of every mission. It seemed to be Deke's fervent belief that it would be only a matter of time, following the next physical or the one after that or the one next year, before he was back on full flight status and into the rotation. And Wally was riding high. Wally's flight was still the shining example of what an operational space flight should be. It had taken Wally's performance to show that Cooper's 22-orbit flight would be possible. Wally couldn't have been in better shape in the program. He had been as efficient and as cool as they made them. Wally had come back from his flight and landed in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis. For a week, Kennedy and Khrushchev had their showdown, which appeared to bring the world to the brink of a nuclear war. But then Khrushchev backed off and withdrew Soviet missiles from Cuba. After that, things cooled down considerably. Like everyone else, the boys noticed that negotiations for a nuclear test ban and for cooperation in space, whatever that might prove to be, were in the news a lot. But to tell the truth, it didn't seem like much more than the usual drizzle of words. For that matter, on May 11th, 4 days before Cooper was to go up, Lyndon Johnson drew the lines the same way they had been drawn ever since October of 1957, when the first Sputnik went up. He made a speech answering charges that some congressmen were making about the high cost of the new programs, Gemini and Apollo. And he said, "I, for one, don't want to go to bed by the light of a communist moon." Christ, that was worse than Sputnik. "Every night, overhead, sails the silvery moon, occupied by the Russians." As for Gordo himself, he was already on top of the world. There were those among his brethren who had their doubts about the man, but he never had a moment's doubt about himself. Once more, his light shone around him. Was he the last of the seven to be assigned a flight? Well, so what? It wasn't a contest. The press had dreamed up all that crap. Shepard, Glenn, and the others had paved the way for his endurance test. The potential hazards? They didn't bother him in the slightest. They hadn't from the beginning. Confronted with any feasible form of manned flight, Gordo was a picture of righteous aplomb. This was a side of Cooper that Jim Rathbun understood better than any of his confreres in the Corps. Gordo had been in Florida for a long stretch preparing for his flight, and he saw Rathbun a lot. Thanks to Rathbun, he, like Gus and Wally and Al, had become crazy about automobile racing. Rathbun, in turn, had decided to learn to fly. Cooper took him up in a Beechcraft one day and told him, "Never fly under a seagull. They'll shit on your plane." Rathbun made the mistake of laughing as if he thought Gordo was kidding, whereupon Gordo said, "I'll show you," and headed for a flock of seagulls flying low over the Everglades. The first thing Rathbun knew, Cooper was down so low he could hear a sound and went, whoop, 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 whoop. It was the propellers cutting the marsh grass. For more than a mile, old Gordo mowed the marsh grass to make sure he stayed under the seagulls. Rathbun could hear it the whole time. Whoop, 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 whoop. By the time they landed, Rathbun was jello. But Cooper just popped open the cockpit door and stood up on the lower frame and pointed triumphantly at the roof and yelled to Rathbun, "Look here, I told you." So far as a Mercury flight was concerned, he seemed to regard it as easy enough. He had lobbied as hard as Dick Slayton himself for more pilot control of the spacecraft. But since you didn't have it, why get excited? Why get your bowels in an uproar? Just take the ride and relax. Early in the morning of May 15th, while it was still dark, Gordo was inserted into the little human holster atop the rocket. As usual, there was a long hold before the liftoff. The doctors monitoring the biomedical telemetry began noticing something very odd. In fact, they couldn't believe it. Every objective reading of the calibrations and printouts indicated that the astronaut had gone to sleep. The man was up there stacking Z's on top of a rocket loaded with 200,000 pounds of liquid oxygen and RP-1. Well, why the hell not? Gordo had had plenty of opportunity to see how the launch days always went. He hit the sack in Hangar S about 10 or 11 the night before, and they woke you up about 3 in the morning in the dark, and they took you out to the rocket, and they lay you down on a contoured couch for 2, 3, 4 hours while they tuned in all the systems for the liftoff. You didn't have a damn thing to do, really, during most of this, so why not catch up on all the sleep you missed? Throughout America, throughout the world, untold millions were by their radios and in front of television sets, waiting for the moment of liftoff, wondering, as always, my God, what goes through a man's mind at a moment like this? Scarcely able to believe it themselves, NASA never supplied the answer. By the moment of liftoff, there was quite a circus in progress out front of Gordo's house in Timber Cove. The genteel beast was outdoing itself in the Death Watch department. One of the television networks had erected a stupendous aerial on the lawn of a house across the way. A gigantic thing about 8 stories high, the better to beam to the world live pictures of the house inside which astronaut Cooper's wife, Trudy, was maintaining her anxious vigil in front of the TV set. Milling around underneath the aerial and in the street and on the sidewalks was the biggest mob of reporters and camera crewmen you could imagine. Slovenly, but nevertheless seemly, they were. They treated Trudy Cooper and their coverage as if she had stepped right out of Life magazine, as if she were wearing a pageboy bob and playing Moonlight in Vermont on the old upright in the family room to keep up the spirits of herself and the children while Gordon's life was on the line in the longest American mission yet. That was rich. By now, the very presence of the beast itself had made any such private and personal response to the event impossible, even in households where the marriage was a lot more solid than Gordo and Trudy's. For the astronaut's wife, the days of the lonely vigil by the telephone with the little ones tugging at her skirt, Edwards or Pax River style, were over. First had come the danger wake, as Louise Shepherd had experienced it, with a big crowd in the house, and a bigger one, the genteel animal, out on the front lawn. Since then, the astronaut's wife had been converted from an individual to a performer, at least for the duration of the night. Ready or willing or good at it or not, it had become an immutable part of the drill. At the completion of the flight, the astronaut's wife had to leave the house and confront the beast and all its cameras and microphones and submit to a press conference and answer questions and be the perfect astronaut's wife with merely the entire world watching. It was this grim prospect that truly lacerated one's heart while Mr. Wonderful was aloft. It was this that gave the test pilot's wife a royal case of nerves in the space age. For the astronaut, the flight consisted of riding the rocket and, God willing, not fucking up. For the wife, the flight consisted of the press conference. The questions they asked you were unbelievably simple-minded, and yet there was no smooth way to feel them. As soon as you touched one, it popped all over your face like bubblegum. What is in your heart? What advice do you have for other women whose husbands have to go through dangerous situations? What's the first meal you plan to cook for Al, Gus, John, Scott, Wally, Gordon? Did you feel you were with him while he was in orbit? Pick out one. Try answering it. Problems of protocol had arisen. Sometimes the genteel animal besieged the mother's house as well as the wife's. John Glenn's mother had been a great hit on television. She looked and sounded like about as ideal a mother as an astronaut could possibly have. She had white hair and a marvelous smile, and when Walter Cronkite on CBS cut from the Cape to New Concord, Ohio, to say a few words to her, she said, "Well, Walter Cronkite," as if she were saying hello to a cousin she hadn't heard from in years. But whom should the networks interview first after a flight? The wife, the mother, or the president? Opinions varied, and this added to the tension. Regardless of the order, however, there seemed to be no way for the wife to get out of it. Even Renee, after hiding throughout Scott's flight, had dutifully turned up at the press tent on the base at the Cape for the wife's press conference. By now, when the other wives came around to the house of the wife during a flight, they were not there to hold her hand over the dangers her husband was facing. They were there to hold her hand over the television camera she would be facing. They were there to try to buck her up for a true ordeal. They liked to do the squarely stable routine. One of the wives, Renee Carpenter, was good at it. would take the role of Nancy Whoever, TV correspondent, and hold her fist up to her mouth as if she were holding a microphone and say, "We're here in front of the trim, modest suburban home of Squarely Stable, the famous astronaut who has just completed his historic mission, and we have with us his attractive wife, Primly Stable. Primly Stable, you must be happy, proud, and thankful at this moment." And then she would shift her fist over underneath the chin of another wife, and she would say, "Yes, Nancy, that's true. I'm happy, proud, and thankful at this moment. Tell us, Primly Stable, may I call you Primly?" "Certainly, Nancy, Primly." "Tell us, Primly, tell us what you felt during the blastoff at the very moment when your husband's rocket began to rise from the earth and take him on this historic journey." "To tell you the truth, Nancy, I missed that part of it. I sort of dozed off because I got up so early this morning and I'd been rushing around a lot taping the shade shut so the TV people wouldn't come in the windows." "Well, would you say you had a lump in your throat as big as a tennis ball?" "That's about the size of it, Nancy. I had a lump in my throat as big as a tennis ball." "And finally, Primly, I know that the most important prayer of your life has already been answered. Squarely has returned safely from outer space, but if you could have one other wish at this moment and have it come true, what would that wish be?" "Well, Nancy, I'd wish for an Electrolux vacuum cleaner with all the attachments." And they'd all crack up at what a dim lummox the genteel beast really was. Still, that didn't make it any easier when your time came. Gordo's flight was to last 34 hours, meaning that Trudy would undergo the longest siege by the beast and have the most protracted danger wake yet. Two sets of wives came by. Louise Shepard brought most of the original seven wives in her convertible. Later on, some of the other nine wives came by. Jim Lovell's wife, Marilyn, Ed White's wife, Pat, Neil Armstrong's wife, Jan, and John Young's wife, Barbara. Everybody tried to listen to Gordo's transmissions from the capsule over a high-frequency radio receiver Wally Schirra had loaned Trudy. It was the receiver that had been in Wally's capsule during his flight, but about all you could get out of it was static. So they went out onto the patio in the back, out of sight of the animal, and watched the television coverage of the flight off and on and ate devil's food cake. In the true spirit of the wake, friends and neighbors had brought over food. During his ninth orbit, which began about 7:30 p.m., Gordo was supposed to try to go to sleep for a few hours, and Trudy decided that she and their two daughters, Jan and Cam, should try to get some rest too. In the morning, Gordo was still up there, 24 hours into the flight, and the beast was still outside the door, and the danger wake was going strong. About noon, as Gordo began his last four orbits, you could tell from the television reports that his capsule was beginning to develop electrical problems. During the next to last orbit, they became worse. It now appeared as if Gordo would have to line up the capsule for re-entry manually, without any assistance from the automatic control system at all. Trudy received a telephone call from Deke Slayton. He told her that she and the children should worry because Gordo had practiced completely manual re-entries many times on the procedure's trainer. "This is what we wanted to do anyway," he said. Well, Gordo was going to have his hands full. Nevertheless, Trudy couldn't help but jump one more step forward in the retro sequence. If Gordo was beginning his re-entry, then, very soon, she would have to step out the front door and face the beast, his cameras and microphones, and go through the press conference. Meantime, aloft, Gordo was having a hell of a time for himself. Right after the liftoff, he said to Wally Schirra, who was serving as the capcom, "Feels good, buddy. All systems go." He kept adding things such as, "working just like advertised." The life sciences people who had finally been allowed a few experiments since the flight was so long were interested in determining the limits of adaptability to weightlessness. They hoped to see what sleep would be like, although they were not sure they could learn anything about this during a 34-hour flight, given the naturally high adrenal excitement of the astronaut. They needn't have worried. Old Gordo obliged by falling asleep during his second orbit. Even though his suit was overheating, and he had to adjust the temperature settings continually. One of his tasks was to provide urine samples at specified intervals. This he dutifully did. Since in a weightless condition, it would be impossible to pour the sample from the urine receptacle, it would have floated about the cockpit as globules. Gordo was provided with a syringe to transfer it from the receptacle to a container. But the syringe leaked all over the place, and Gordo had the reeking amber globules floating around anyway. So he just tried to herd them together into one big blob periodically and went on with his task, which included light and photographic experiments, somewhat like Carpenter's. Gordo was really something. He seemed even cooler about the whole thing than Shirah, and nobody had believed that possible. Every now and then, he would look out the window and give the folks on the ground a little travelogue, Gordo style. "Down there are the Himalayas," he said. He seemed to like the sound of the word. "Aya, the Himalayas." In Oklahoma lingo Gordo, it came out Himalayas. On the 19th orbit, with three more to go, Gordo started getting readings of G-force buildups, as if the capsule had begun its re-entry. Sure enough, the capsule started rolling, just as it would have during a re-entry in order to increase stability. The automatic control system had begun the re-entry sequence, even though the capsule was still in orbit and hadn't slowed down in the slightest. The electrical system was shorting out. On the next orbit, the 20th, the capsule lost all attitude readings. This meant Gordo would have to line it up manually for the re-entry. On the next to the last orbit, the 21st, the automatic control system went out completely. For re-entry, Cooper would not only have to establish the capsule's angle of attack by hand, using the horizon as his point of reference, he would also have to hold the capsule steady on all three axes, pitch, roll, and yaw, with the hand controller, and fire the retro rockets by hand. Meantime, the electrical malfunction had done something to the oxygen balance. Carbon dioxide started building up in the capsule, and inside Cooper's suit and helmet as well.
Well, things are beginning to stack up a little, said Gordo. It was the same old sod hut drawl. He sounded like the airline pilot who, having just slipped two seemingly certain mid-air collisions and finding himself in the midst of a radar fuse-out and control tower dysarthria, says over the intercom, Well, ladies and gentlemen, we'll be busy up here in the cockpit making our final approach into Pittsburgh, and so we want to take this opportunity to thank you for flying American, and we hope we'll see you again real soon. It was second-generation Jaeger, now coming from Earth orbit. Cooper was having a good time. He knew everybody was in a sweat down below, but this was what he and the boys had wanted all along, wasn't it? They had wanted to take over the complete re-entry process, become true pilots in this damn thing, bring her in manually, and the engineers had always shuddered at the thought. Well, now they had no other choice, and he had the controls. On top of that, during his final orbit, he would have to keep the capsule at the proper angle, by eye, on the night side of the Earth, and then be ready to fire the retro rockets soon after he entered daylight over the Pacific. No sweat. Just make it a little more of a sporty course, that was all. And Gordo lined up the capsule, hit the button for the retro rockets, and splashed down even closer to the carrier Kearsage than Shirah had. No one could deny it. No brethren, old or new, could fail to see it. When the evil wind was up, old Gordo had shown the world the pure and righteous stuff. Over the next week, Gordo became the most celebrated of all the astronauts, aside from John Glenn himself. Old Gordo, whose confreres had pictured him as forever bringing up the rear. There he was, sitting on the back of the open limousine in parade after parade, Honolulu, Cocoa Beach, Washington, New York, and such parades. The ticker tape parade in New York was one of the biggest ever, Glenscale, with signs along the way saying such as, "Gordo Cooper, you're super duper," in letters 3 or 4 feet high. Not only that, he addressed a joint session of Congress, just as Glenn had. A textbook flight like Shiraz was all well and good, but there was nothing like a hair raiser to capture the imagination and stir the gourds. Gordo was also the first American to spend an entire day in space, of course, and he had put the United States back in the ballgame with the Soviets. The role of single combat warrior seemed more glorious than ever. Chapter 15. The High Desert. By the time of Gordon Cooper's flight, Chuck Yeager had returned to Edwards Air Force Base. He was only 39, the same age, it so happened, as Wally Schirra and Alan Shepard, and 2 years younger than John Glenn. Yeager no longer had quite the head of dark curly hair that everybody at Edwards saw in the framed photographs of him stepping out of the X-1 in October 1947. And God knows his face had more mileage on it. This was typical of military pilots by that age and came not so much from the rigors of the job as from taking the sun rays head-on 12 months every year out on the concrete of the flight lines. Yeager had the same trim muscular build as always. He had been flying supersonic fighter aircraft as regularly day in and day out as any colonel in the Air Force. So in the 10 years since he had made his last record-setting flight here at Edwards, that wild ride to Mach 2.4 in the X-1A, he really hadn't changed too much. You couldn't say the same about Edwards itself. When Yeager had departed in 1954, Poncho's had still been standing. Today the base was loaded with military and civil service personnel, every GS type in the manual, working for the Air Force, for NASA, even for the Navy, which had a small piece of the X-15 program. At 4 o'clock, it was worth your life to be heading upstream during the mad rush from the air conditioners in the office buildings to the air conditioners in the tract homes in Lancaster. This much Yeager already knew about. This was the part that was easy to take. He had been commanding a squadron of F-100s at George Air Force Base, which is only about 50 miles southeast of Edwards, in the same stretch of prehistoric dry lake terrain. Yeager and Glennis and their 4 children had lived in Victorville in the same sort of housing development you found in Lancaster, just a bit more barren, if anything. A little grid of contractor suburbans lined up alongside Interstate Highway 15. The same old arthritic Joshua trees dared you to grow a blade of grass, much less a real tree, and the cars heading from Los Angeles to Las Vegas hurtled by without so much as a flick of the eye. Not that any of this weighed upon Yeager, however. As commander of a squadron of supersonic fighters, he had led training operations and readiness maneuvers over half the world and as far away as Japan. Besides, nobody stayed in the Air Force because of the glories of the domestic architecture. Where he was living was standard issue for a colonel such as himself, who after 20 years was making just a little over $200 a week, including extra flight pay and living allowance, and without magazine contracts or any other unorthodox goodies. The Air Force had brought Yeager back to Edwards 2 years ago to be director of flight test operations. Last year, 1962, they created the new Aerospace Research Pilot School and made him commandant. ARPS, ARPS, as the school became known, was part of big plans the Air Force had for a manned space program of its own. As a matter of fact, the Air Force had envisioned a major role in space ever since the first Sputnik went up, only to be thwarted by Eisenhower's decision to put the space effort in civilian hands. They now wanted to create a military program quite apart from NASA's, using fleets of ships such as the X-20 and various lifting body craft, wingless ships, whose hulls would be shaped to give them aerodynamic control when they re-entered the Earth's atmosphere, and the manned orbiting laboratory, which would be a space station. Boeing was building the first X-20 at its plant in Seattle. The Titan 3C rocket booster it would require was almost ready. 6 pilots had already been chosen to train to take it into orbit.
The X-20 and the MOL were not yet operational, of course. In the meantime, it seemed to be highly important that Air Force pilots be chosen as NASA astronauts. The prestige of the astronaut absolutely dominated flying, and the Air Force was determined to be the prime supplier of the breed. Four of the 9 new astronauts selected in 1962 before ARPS was instituted had been from the Air Force. That was not considered good enough. To tell the truth, the brass had gone slightly bananas over this business of producing astronauts. They had even set up a charm school in Washington for the leading candidates. The best of the young test pilots from Edwards and Wright-Patterson flew to Washington and were given a course in how to impress the NASA selection panels in Houston. And it was dead serious. They listened to pep talks by Air Force generals, including General Curtis LeMay himself. They went through drills on how to talk on their feet, and that was the more sensible, credible part of the course. From there, it got right down to the level of cotillion etiquette. They were told what to wear to the interviews with the engineers and the astronauts. They were to wear knee-length socks so that when they sat down and crossed their legs, no bare flesh would show between the top of the socks and bottom of the pant cuffs. They were told what to drink at the social get-togethers in Houston. They should drink alcohol in keeping with the pilot code of flying and drinking, but in the form of a tall highball, either bourbon or scotch, and only one. They were told how to put their hands on their hips, if they must. The thumb should be to the rear and the fingers forward. Only women and interior decorators put the thumbs forward and the fingers back. And the men went through it all willingly, without a snigger. The brass's passion for the astronaut business was nothing compared to that of the young pilots themselves. Edwards had always been the precise location on the map of the apex of the pyramid of the right stuff itself. And now it was just another step on the way up. These boys were coming through Chuck Yeager's prep school so they could get a ticket to Houston. The glamour of the space program was such that there was no longer any arguing against it. In addition to the chances for honor, glory, fame, and the celebrity treatment, all the new hot dogs could see something else. It practically glowed in the sky. They talked about it at every beer call, at every officers' club, at every airbase in the land. Namely, the astronaut life. The youngsters knew about that, all right. It existed just over the rainbow in Houston, Texas. The life contract, $25,000 per year over and above your salary, veritable mansions in the suburbs, custom design, no more poor, sad, dried-up asbestos shingle roof clapboard shacks rattling in the sandstorms, free Corvettes, an enormous free lunch from one side of America to the other, for that matter, and the tastiest young cookies imaginable. One had only to reach for them. The vision of all the little sugar plums danced above the mighty ziggurat. You bet! A veritable fighter jock's forbidden dream of the goodies had been brought to life, and all these young hot dogs looked upon it like people who believe in miracles. It really made some of the older pilots shake their heads. If a man got a piece of tail every now and then, the world wasn't going to come to an end. But to dream of a goddamn aerial nookie circus? What was worse, however, was the life contract. The way any true blue suitor saw it, to let an experimental test pilot exploit his job commercially was only asking for trouble. If a man had the opportunity to fly machines with incalculable millions of dollars worth of resources and facilities and man hours built into them, if they put him in a position to make history, that was more than enough compensation. Yeager had flown the X-1 at straight pay, $283 a month. The blue suit. That was enough for him. The blue suit had bought him everything he had in this world, and he asked for nothing else. And what would all of that mean to these boys, even if someone said it? Not a hell of a lot, probably. Not even the fact that the X-15 project was in its finest hour, right here for all to see, affected the new order of things. In June, the X-15 with Joe Walker at the controls had achieved Mach 5.92, or 4,104 miles per hour, which brought the project close to the optimum speed, in excess of Mach 6 it had been aiming for. In July, Bob White had flown to 314,750 feet, or 59.6 miles. 9.6 miles into space, 50 miles was now officially regarded as the boundary line, and well above the project's goal of 280,000 feet. These and many less spectacular flights of the X-15 were bringing back data concerning heat buildup from air friction, a stability upon which the design of all the supersonic and hypersonic aircraft of the future, commercial and military, would be used. The X-15's XLR-99 rocket had 57,000 pounds of thrust. The Mercury Redstone had 78,000. The Mercury Atlas had 367,000 pounds. But soon, there would be the X-20. And the X-20 would have a Titan III rocket's 2.5 million pounds of thrust, and it would be the first ship to go into orbit with a pilot at the controls from beginning to end. A pilot who could land it anywhere he wanted, eliminating the tremendous expense and risk of the Mercury's ocean rescue operations, which involved carriers, spotter planes, helicopters, frogmen, and backup vessels strung halfway around the world. Yeager's students had a chance to experience something close to what space piloting would be like. They went booming and zooming in the F-104. The F-104 was a fighter interceptor that had been built to counter the MiG-21, which the Russians were known to be developing. The F-104 was 50 feet long and had two razor-thin wings, each only 7 feet long, set far back on the fuselage, close to the tail assembly. The pilot and his guy in back were in two seats way up in the nose. The F-104 was built for speed in combat, period. It could climb at speeds in excess of Mach 1, and it could achieve Mach 2.2 in level flight. The faster it went, the steadier it was. It was unstable at low speeds, however, and oversensitive to the controls, with an evil tendency to pitch up and then snap into rolls and spins. At glide speed, it seemed to want to fall like a length of pipe. After practicing on an F-104 simulator, Yeager students would take the ship up to 35,000 feet and open her up to Mach 2, the boom. Then aim her up at about 45 degrees and try to poke a hole in the sky, the zoom. The G-forces slammed them back in their seats and they shot up like shells, and the pale blue desert sky turned blue-black, and the G-forces slid off and they came sailing over the top of the arc about 75,000 feet up, silent and weightless, an experience like unto what the brethren themselves had known. And these boys thought that was neat. Maybe it would be nice to fly the X-15 or the X-20, if you didn't make astronaut. Yeager liked to take the ARP students up for mock dogfights. Hassling, just to keep the proficiency up. Few of the lads had ever been in combat, and they knew little about the critical tolerances of fighter aircraft during violent maneuvers. They knew where the outside of the envelope was, but they didn't know the part about where you reached the outside and then stretched her a little without breaking through. Yeager waxed their tails with regularity, but they took that in stride. These days, the way to the top, meaning the road to test pilot astronaut, involved being very good at a lot of things, without necessarily being shit hot, to use the beer call expression, at anything. A balance of pilot skills and engineering, that was the ticket. Joe Walker's backup pilot in the X-15 project, Neil Armstrong, was typical of the new breed. A lot of people couldn't figure out Armstrong. He had a close, blonde crew cut, and small pale blue eyes, and scarcely a line or feature in his face that you could remember. His expression hardly ever changed. You'd ask him a question, and he'd just stare at you with those pale blue eyes of his, and you'd start to ask the question again, figuring he hadn't understood, and click, out of his mouth would come forth a sequence of long, quiet, perfectly formed, precisely thought-out sentences full of anisotropic functions and multiple encounter trajectories, or whatever else was called for. It was as if his hesitations were just data punch-in intervals for his computer. Armstrong had been preparing for an X-15 launch from Smith's Ranch dry lake bed last year when Yeager, who was director of flight test operations, told him the lake bed was still too muddy from the rains. Armstrong said the meteorological data, considering the wind and temperature factors, indicated the surface would be satisfactory. Yeager received a call from NASA asking him if he would take a small plane over to the lake bed and make a ground inspection. "Hell no," said Yeager. "I've been flying over these lakes for 15 years, and I know it's muddy. I'm not going to be responsible for disabling an Air Force plane."